Evening, ladies and gentlemen. We have a small but very exclusive audience, and tonight the presentations that are being given are going to be recorded by Connemara FM, and they're going to be rebroadcast so that people who weren't able to be here tonight and those people who live outside Connemara, this stuff will be available for them. We'll be also putting all the presentations up online. And I want to thank the Chamber of Commerce, the Connemara Chamber of Commerce, the Bank of Ireland, the Station House for helping us set up this meeting and inviting people, finding our speakers for us and making sure that we have access to some of the best information that's available. The panelists and the experts who are here have been to various clinics and various briefings by government, by their own associations, by their companies, both here in Ireland and internationally. So they bring with them an understanding of what's being talked about Brexit, not just inside their own companies, but also inside their sectors. And they will be talking about tourism and retail, we'll be talking about manufacturing and moving stuff in and out, which is critical to the cost of being able to do business in Connemara. We'll be talking about that, tariffs on things like fish, on construction, on glassware, on arts, on crafts, and lots of other areas. We'll also be looking at something which most people wouldn't be aware of, but what kind of impact has it on, say, our voluntary organisations like the Lifeboat? The Lifeboats are made in England. All their engines and their parts are made in England. And as of the 29th of March, as things stand at the moment, those boats may not be able to operate. We may not be able to maintain them. The certificates which have been given to the crews come from England. They may not be recognised out here. And for our fishermen and our sailors and the people who use the seas, this would be a huge loss to us. Because Clifton and Connemara, I don't know whether you know, but it contributes more per head of population to the lifeboats than any other place in the British Isles. So maintaining and ensuring that we understand that our voluntary services, as well as everything else, are protected and maintained, and we can continue to enjoy and pass on that enjoyment to our visitors, will be critical. The key thing to remember about Brexit, it doesn't matter when it's going to happen. And the information that we're getting from Brussels at the moment is that there may be an extra year given to the English to go along and negotiate among themselves as to how they would like to leave the EU. Because the key negotiation is not between the UK and Europe. It's actually infighting inside England that is trying to decide how they would actually like to leave and what impact that will have. Irrespective of what Brexit looks like, it is going to hit us in the pocket. The Central Bank and the ERSI did a study, and they calculated, accepted by the government and the EU, that it will cost every average family in Ireland between 900 and 1,500 euros per year, irrespective of anything else. That is just the cost that is implied by having to bring all the stuff that we rely on from the United Kingdom into Ireland so that we can live. And to give you an idea, Nestlé import 2,300 lorries of goods every single year. Ireland doesn't produce cornflakes. They all come in through England. And after Brexit, every packet of cornflakes will have 23% VAT plus customs duty put on top of it. Now, I'm going to be eating porridge after Brexit, you know? So it's going to impact just about everything that we eat, we touch, we do, and we use. Because Ireland and England have always been considered by the outside world as one market. We think the same, we eat the same foods, it's very familiar. So what we're trying to do tonight is actually there are over 490 areas that Brexit is going to impact in Ireland and the relationships with the EU. So what we've done tonight is condense those down into three key themes. And the first one is tourism and retail. This is huge for us. It is the core of our economy out here in terms we get people in, those people eat in our restaurants, they go along and do activities, they go along and buy in our shops. So it's critically important to understand the impact on accommodation and on retail and on activities of what happens if we lose the 18% of our market that comes from Northern Ireland or from England. So we have to somehow look at how do we get around that, and we have some suggestions on that. Next, we'll be looking at logistics. This is how we move things in and out of Connemara to sell it, whether it's our smoked salmon, whether it's our fish, whether it's our shellfish, our glassware, or anything else that we do, Leo Mansfield's Connemara t-shirts. They have to be moved across a border. They have to be sent out. So we've got people who will talk to us about logistics and how that changes under Brexit. And then we'll be looking at probably the most important thing, which is how does it impact your bottom line? What is it going to mean to you at the end of next year, this time next year, when you're doing your accounts? What is it going to mean? Are you going to be better off? Are you going to be worse off? And if there's a danger to your income, how can you protect yourself? And we'll be having a talk on that. After we've had three presentations, we will be then going into a short panel discussion, and then it'll be open to each and every one of you to ask at least 10 questions of our panel to make up for the empty seats that we've got here tonight. But there's one thing that is certain, no matter how bumpy the road is to Brexit, it'll never be as bad as the M59. And our panellists, they have come here from all across the country. What we're going to have first, these are our speakers. And we have Gerardo Larios Liso, who will be talking about tourism and hospitality. He's from the Bank of Ireland. He's been down a number of times to speak before on the shape of tourism and various other things. We have Eddie Meaney, the head of customs and aviation from DHL. And Eddie has been looking at how the logistics industry, and this involves Post and everybody else, they all have the same rules and regulations. So he'll be talking to us about how the logistics industry are going to have to adapt to Brexit and how they're going to be helping us to go along and be more efficient. Then we have Rory Call. Rory has customers in the UK and in Ireland. So he has an understanding of the two markets and what we're beginning to see there in terms of preparations for both. So he will go along and help us. Then we have a panel. We'll be joined by two people there after that. First is Brigida Fox from the local enterprise office in Galway, who will be talking to us about the financial supports that are available to us, because Brexit is going to put a cost on all of our businesses. So there are very special things that are available to us. The government announced an extra 110 million in the budget, and that brings the amount that they're putting into Brexit this year to 700 million. So we'll be dealing with that. And then we have David Waldron from the Irish SME Association, Small and Medium-Sized Business Association, to talk to us, or sitting on the panel, and explain to us what he's finding in the rest of the country about how people are preparing and what goes on. So without any further ado, I'm going to hand over to Gerardo to talk about tourism and its impact.
Good evening, and thanks again for the invitation to speak to you guys. Again, I'm just going to give you a very brief synopsis of where we are, the main key drivers that we have actually in both supply and demand in the country for the sector. And first of all, obviously starting with just a couple of slides specifically on Brexit. As we all know at the moment, is quite topical. This is the withdrawal agreement that is actually being negotiated. And the citizens' rights have been fully agreed. Financial settlement is agreed. Transitional agreement is being agreed as well, as we know. I mean, it's supposed to be December 2020, could be moved further. So the impact that could actually have is just that there'll be no tariffs or anything else. Well, I'm sure somebody else would explain it better after me now. But so there's nothing really to worry about. The only thing that hasn't really been settled, which is probably the more annoying one for the tourism point of view, is the border controls, which are obviously, they were quite heavily discussed today in the radio. Anybody who's listened to radio or TV would have heard loads about it. And that is actually still ongoing. Well, it's annoying because that's actually delaying the whole thing. Now, I'm sure you're familiar with it. I mean, the decision has to be made by the 29th. It has to be ratified by the European Parliament, the UK Parliament, and the EU Council. So if it hasn't been ratified by then, they'll expect it to be just a further delay or the no-deal Brexit. The likelihood is that the no-deal Brexit is not really an option. It'll just be a further delay in the negotiations, and which will have actually further consequences in terms of the transitional agreement, which is already being quite protracted. Now, in terms of the actual impact of Brexit has had so far on the tourism and hospitality sector at Wife, it hasn't actually been heartfelt because of different changes in the demand that we have in the country. So if you look at the slide there, back in 2001, over 50%, nearly 60% of the visitors to the country were coming from the UK and Northern Ireland. If you roll back to 2007, that actually had already dropped down to 42%. And if you don't roll back to 2017, that has actually dropped down to 33%. So we've been actually not shedding, but I mean, the numbers that we're actually getting from the UK have been dropping consistently. Even though they've actually grown a little bit over the last couple of years, they haven't grown to the extent that all the other markets are actually growing. And therefore, the market mix that we actually have in the country at present is a lot more balanced. It's very, very beneficial to different businesses because we're getting a lot more Americans and we're getting a lot more continental Europeans. And I'll talk about their average spend and the impact that they have in a couple of slides later. Now, in terms of the domestic demand, that actually represents the domestic demand for the West region, as the figures reported by Fawlty Ireland in Tourism Facts. And as you can see there, that's actually been quite bumpy. But what you've always been quite consistent in the region is the percentage of the business that you actually command. The Southwest is actually one of the favorite regions for domestic tourism. And as you can see there, you're nearly at 20% there from 2017, it's at 17%. Which is actually among the highest in the country. It's only actually second to Dublin region. And Dublin is always going to command more visitors purely because of the amount of events that are actually ongoing in the city. But in terms of the domestic tourism, you have capitalized a big chunk of it. And it is a very, very important market that you can see historically has had the power to actually shape the economy around here. And obviously impacting that domestic tourism is the unemployment levels that are currently at just nearly going down to 5%. So having that level of unemployment is really benefiting the domestic demand, and that's actually a market that is, again, historically produced very, very strongly for the region and should continue to produce should the right efforts actually be put into it. Now, in terms of the average spend that I was mentioning to you, that shift that we had in the key markets visiting the country is being quite dramatic when you look at the actual economic impact that they have. If you look at the bottom line of that slide, is the average spend by visitor market. So if you look at Britain, the British market, it's 298 euro per person per trip that will be spent on average in Ireland. And you compare that against the North American market at $430, you can see then the impact that every single American additional visitor would have as opposed to a UK visitor. So obviously, we're having a lot more American visitors, as you could see in previous slide, and they're not only actually coming in larger numbers, but they're spending a lot more money. That's why the impact of tourism has actually been so great over the last couple of years, because we're getting a really, really good mix of visitors. We're actually getting less of the visitors that spend less money, and more visitors of those that are actually spending key money in the country. So that is actually incredibly important, and this is actually just for the region itself. If you look at a nationwide level, the actual spend from the domestic market is actually slightly lower, and the domestic market here spend is 220 euro, which is also very, very good. Now, in terms of the supply then, you would expect with the huge rise in demand that there would have been more hotels opening or more B&Bs opening. The reality is that the market is actually changing quite dramatically. So in the past, we would have actually had about 100 more hotels than what we have now. And it isn't only that hotels are closing, but it is the hotels that are closing tend to be the 2 and the 3 star hotels. airport, particularly the one and the two-star and a few of the three-star hotels. And there's also been a lot of emphasis on actually reinvesting on the hotel assets and B&Bs and whatever not, because demand now is a lot more discerning. So you have about, if you look at just the number of the four stars, there used to be 230 and now there's actually 304. Over 70 hotels would have actually reclassified from being a three-star to a four-star. And it's because people are investing in those assets and they're actually wanting to actually get the higher grading. Even at a five-star level, we actually have six hotels more than we would have actually had 10 years ago. So it is very important to know the market is changing. It's actually becoming a little bit more demanding in terms of the requirements for a better product. And that's actually driving these classifications. It's actually a peer response of that demand. People are paying a lot more for the rooms, and and as a consequence, they're expecting the products to actually be better. So if you have a product that is actually still in the one or two-star category, or a guest house, or a product that is actually falling below par, well, you know where you have to look at. I mean, the market is actually moving in that direction, and you don't want to be the one with the inferior product if the demand actually softens further. Now, it's a very similar story. We're looking actually at pubs and restaurants. Now, the data for restaurants is a bit marred, but the number of pub registrations is very clear. So that actually just shows a trend in terms of the, I'm not sure whether you're aware of this or not, but if you have a pub, you would actually pay your license, your excise license, according to the level of turnover that you have. So if you have less turnover, you pay a smaller license. And if you have higher turnover, you pay a higher license. And that's actually the segmentation that you have there. So between 0 to 200,000, you pay 250 quid. And if it's 1.27 million or more, you pay 3,800. And what you can see from there is that the pubs that have actually been closing down over the last couple of years have all been in the what we call the lifestyle segment. A pub that generates less than 300,000 a year is generally a lifestyle pub, because what you would actually be able to make out of the trade of a pub like that is generally only enough to keep a family going, but it wouldn't be really, you wouldn't be, you know, making a fortune out of it. So those small pubs are the ones that have been closing down. But if you look at the bottom line, the ones with the higher turnover, 1.27 million more, have actually grown significantly. And the reason that they're actually growing significantly is because demand as well nowadays has actually changed in the pub sector for having more food and having more refined options in terms of like more gins and whatever not. So that's obviously having an impact on the turnover for those businesses. So the businesses that actually have managed to adapt their product and start selling quality food, or you know, changing with the customer trends, are the ones that are capitalizing. And the ones that have failed to adapt because they just don't have the monetary power to actually do those changes are the ones that are actually closing. It's a very sad story, but that's actually the way that it is going. The smaller hotels and the smaller pubs are the ones that are being phased out. So it is important that if you have a small hotel or a small pub or a small B&B, that you have a clearly distinguishable factor. You need to have a bit of a wow if you're gonna be able to make it within the changing environment. Sorry, one thing that is obviously driving the closure of all those small pubs is the fact that obviously as a nation we're drinking less and less and less. There's a lot of government initiatives that are actually directed specifically at reducing the alcohol consumption. And as you can see there, the alcohol consumption has actually dropped from being about 14 litres per adult back in 2001 to just over 11 litres by 2017. The government actually has a plan to reduce that to 9.1, which is 20% reduction on what we currently have. So you can imagine that the tight regulations are really going to have an impact, you know, on those smaller pubs, which is a further reduction in the consumption. Now, obviously, part of the regulations that the government would actually be put in place is to try to incentivize a particular segment or a particular industry when it's ailing. And during the years, you have a few of the examples there of the things that would have happened. Where you have your stamp duty going up and down, the VAT going up and down, and obviously the latest one to actually have hit the sector really bad at the moment is the increase in the VAT. Because it's not only the increase of 4.5% from 9 to 13.5%, it's also at the same time you're talking about a 4.5% decrease in VAT, you're also increasing the average, the minimum wage by 3.5%. So you're hitting both in the cost of wages and in the VAT. So the actual impact is gonna be quite steep in the bottom line, you know, the region of about 5% or so. So it's important to know that going forward, businesses have to be a little bit more efficient in managing their cost. And if there's something that hadn't been actually thought of before, you need to challenge it because that cost base is gonna be eroding a little bit faster. Now, in terms of the impact, the direct impact of Brexit into the sector, obviously the first one will be the demand. And the demand, the fluctuation of the demand from the UK market has always been, you know, it has ups and downs because it's intrinsically related just to the exchange rates. The new player game, the new player into the game this time around will be obviously the border controls that haven't actually been in place for, you know, a very long time. So if those are to be implemented, they're going to have a further disruption in terms of like wedding bookings and things like that. You might actually not feel it here, but if you're to be running a business in Donegal or in Monaghan, you depend a lot of, first of all, in the day trade. People that just go there for the day, have a, you know, a soup and a sandwich, do a bit of shopping and whatever not. Those have actually already reduced quite dramatically because the spending power is being altered by the exchange rates. But then you have the kind of the longer commitments, which is the case of like little conferences or weddings. And those, because people tend to look ahead, the impact of those won't be felt until 1 or 2 or 3 years from now, because you know people actually are waiting to make those bookings, waiting to actually pay those deposits, because they don't want to be a commitment where they're not, as there's uncertainty about borders and there'll be uncertainty about the rates that they'll be having to pay. One of the main things that I think is actually having an impact on, and which is the second point in there, is actually just more so the sentiment around businesses in the country. Those businesses that are actually more exposed to are the ones that are actually at the moment not investing in their assets. The ESR, the Economic and Social Research Institute, released a report recently where it determined that Irish businesses, SMEs, are investing about 30% less than the European counterparts in their businesses over the last 2 years. And that is actually largely associated with Brexit, because companies here are a little bit more exposed, and obviously it's actually putting a stop in people's plans. You know, they're waiting and to see what happens, to see what the final resolution is. And because that is being so protracted, that is actually stopping a lot of businesses from carrying on investment in their assets. So that is actually a very important point, and that's why I should have in that. And then the third one, which we'll be discussing in detail, is really the supply chain. And obviously hotels have an awful lot of products that they'll actually be buying from the UK. And obviously it is just a matter of actually planning and starting to think what other alternatives are there in terms of those product sources. Now, what are the mitigants then to Brexit and the confusion that is around it? Well, first of all, we have, as I was saying earlier on, we're getting a lot more visitors. You know, we're very lucky in Ireland that we have, at the moment, record number of visitors. They've literally never been as many people coming to the country as we have now. And we have a lot more Americans and a lot more Europeans that are spending a lot of money. We have new flights coming in this year into Shannon and Dublin. You know, we are incredibly lucky. I was actually just in Belfast yesterday and left this morning, and they've actually lost a couple of the international flights that they got. They had one from Norwegian, which they couldn't retain, and they have a couple of others that they've been trying to get for years, and they literally just lost a contract the week before last. So, you know, from all the little woes that we have of Brexit, at least we have a very steady number of visitors. We're still actually a very attractive destination. So that is, I think, the most important mitigant of all. Second of all, we have obviously the tourism initiatives from Folk Ireland and Tourism Ireland. For the last, I think, 6-7 years, Niall Gibbons and Tourism Ireland has actually been focusing big efforts into the Asian market. You know, he's been beating the drum. It's a slow burner. You know, the visitor numbers keep doubling every year. You might not notice them because, I mean, they went from 10 to 20,000 or 20 to 40,000. We're not talking about the millions that we get from the US or the millions from continental Europe. But in the longer term, it's expected that actually that will pay off. Food tourism, there's a number of food tourism initiatives, and there's a lot of potential in that in terms of both for food producers, because it allows hospitality businesses to actually focus on locally produced goods. At the moment, one of the biggest initiatives from Folk Ireland is all about provenance of the food, and they have special incentives for hotels and bars and restaurants that are actually using locally sourced products. The good thing about that is obviously that it benefits the food producers and the beverage producers, as well as actually creating an attractive point for the food tourism. Obviously, the point in there in terms of tourism initiatives and that you're part of is the Wild Atlantic Way. It is still actually the biggest money maker that the country has come up with in terms of a tourism initiative, and there's still been money being pumped into it, and a lot of money that will still be pumped in 2019. So you can consider this quite lucky, because you're actually, you know, within the Wild Atlantic Way, and that is actually still growing reputation worldwide. Digital distribution, I was actually speaking to Terry Aaron about it. I mean, it's very important that businesses start already looking at the distribution of their product in different means rather than the traditional ones, because the different distribution channels that you might actually be using at the moment or you could consider using have different reaches. So if you're using or focusing on one that is specifically tailored for the UK market, you will be losing out then on trying to diversify in the future, which is my next slide. For example, if you were to be a hotelier and you're only using, or even a B&B, you're using only Booking.com. Booking.com is predominantly UK market, where Expedia would actually be for the American market. And it might not be a thing that a lot of people would consider, because you say, well, Booking.com is the one that we would all use in Ireland. Yes, it is predominantly European. But if you're not in Expedia, you're never going to be able to actually reach the American market to the extent that the Booking.com does. Because even though they charge a little bit more commission, because they are more expensive to use Expedia, they have the reach to that particular market. So it is important that those things are considered. And the last point there is actually the collaboration between businesses. That is an essential point. Every destination that is actually successful, you know, the likes of yourselves here in Connemara, you look the likes of like Westport, they all have like very strong business associations. Like in particular Westport, for example, which is so strong for domestic tourism, they have an association called Destination Westport, and they all businesses meet on a regular basis. They come with different initiatives. They produce their own funding, and then they just actually go to Falls to Ireland with it, and they get a percentage of their own investment backed in by the government. But it is all about actually organizing yourselves, because the initiatives are actually there for the government to support projects, but you need to have a project to actually start with. So what can you do? What are the many important things that you actually have to focus on? First of all, you have to assess the impact. If you only have a business that you buy primarily locally, and you only have 2 or 3% from your tourism coming from the UK, then don't panic, don't worry about it. There's nothing concrete, there's nothing in stone at the moment anyway. So there's no point in actually looking to fix something that isn't broken. So that'll be the first thing really. Then you have to review the distribution channels, which I mentioned earlier on. Review your supply chain, which shall be, somebody will be speaking probably a lot more in detail than I could ever do. Improve your competitiveness and reputation. That's actually a key one. As I say, at the moment, we actually are at a particularly high level of demand in the country. We never had the level of visitors that we're having right now. So if at this time, this point in time, you're not at 100% occupancy, you're not actually driving the business optimally, what's going to happen with that level of demand softens? Ideally, you should be trying to actually, position yourself within the top 5 businesses or the top 1 within your reach, to make sure that if there's a change in the market conditions in both demand or supply, at least you're protected by your reputation. Even if you're not the largest player, if you offer the best service, there's actually something that people can relate to and something that would actually make your business last. Next one is that I mentioned this again, it's just the diversification of markets through different distribution channels. And again, it's just considering what other alternatives are there to actually sell your product apart from your traditional ones. And the initiatives that I was mentioning in the last one, that's obviously a big, big opportunity to every community in the country. And it is just about making sure you're focusing on the right aspect and that you're including as many of the business as possible. Because the more companies that are actually involved in an initiative gives you the more strength and the more likelihood that you actually be able to source the funding that I'm sure that quite a few people here are familiar with the application process and the red tape. But I mean, having the support from a big contingent of the community always makes a big difference. That's it.
Next up, we have Eddie Meaney, who will be talking to us about logistics, moving stuff in and out of Connemara.
Good evening, everybody. I'd like to thank you all for the invitation to be here this evening. So DHL Express, we're the largest international express carrier in the world. We have a touch point in over 220 countries, so we are the experts in terms of moving goods around the world. But even for us, Brexit is going to have a significant impact. And I suppose the key word is preparation for the fact that we are going to have a hard Brexit. So it's hope for the best, but prepare for the worst in terms of what's going to happen with Brexit. So my agenda today is just looking at Brexit itself, getting prepared for it, what's going to happen, what you need to do around logistics, the impact that we have, and some contingencies that you need to put in place. So from a DHL point of view, we're looking at Brexit as a huge change in terms of logistics, where previously the UK is part of the single market there within the customs union. If a hard Brexit is to take place, they'll no longer be in the single market, and effectively the UK becomes a third country. So this is going to require customs declarations on all goods imported and exported from the UK. And also then when they arrive in the UK, you're also going to require a customs declaration on that side, both at import and at export. So we put together a task force in terms of the 27 member states, each country, and then also within the UK itself. You know, we're looking at contingency planning for the movement of goods across borders, the impact that we have there. A review of all of our IT systems and the impact that Brexit has on those systems. Forecasting for the number of declarations that's going to be required. So if you look at Ireland alone at the moment, the number of declarations, revenue are preparing for five times the number of customs declarations than they currently have to do at the moment, which is a significant increase and a huge impact in terms of the country. Permits, licenses that are required for trucks moving to and from the UK, and then contingency planning around the movement of aircraft. We've all heard in the news some of the impacts that that can be there, but we've also looked at that from in terms of how we're going to move our product across our network in terms of the registration of aircrafts. And all of these things we're starting to prepare for. So a company the size of ourselves, one thing that we notice is a lot of the multinationals are also starting to prepare for a hard Brexit. And what I'm telling a lot of SMEs now is that they need to be doing the same. Because getting prepared for a hard Brexit is the best strategy you can have at the moment in terms of planning. And some of the things you need to be looking at is where you're currently importing and exporting from. What's the percentage of your goods that are currently imported and exported from the UK? In terms of the impact on your business, what's going to be the cost for that? What logistics provider will you use, and what mode of transport will you use? So how do you currently move your products to and from the UK? How much stock can you hold prior to the 1st of April? So looking at how much you can import prior to that, is there a lifespan on your stock in terms of what you have, or can you import large bulk goods and store them so that the impact on you, if it comes around to a hard Brexit on the 1st of April, that you're not impacted straight away. Understand your customs requirements for non-EU exports, as the UK will effectively become a third country and revert to WTO. And understanding and selecting the appropriate terms of trade and selecting the right carrier. So based on the type of product you move, do you move a product which has a very short lifespan, or are you moving bulk goods that it will allow you to move your goods by a slower means of transport? So when we look at Brexit and the impact in terms of customs, so the UK becomes a third country. Everything imported and exported from the UK over a value of €22 will require a customs declaration. So basically that's a SAD, a single administrative document. So this is basically a compliance document in terms of declaring what your goods are that you're importing, but then also it will calculate the duties and taxes that will be applicable on your goods. Previously, goods that are imported from the UK, you would do a VAT return at the end of the month through your Visa, your Intrastat, and you're not impacted in any way. What will happen is if and when the UK leave through a hard Brexit, you will be required to make a payment of the taxes up front. So all duty and VAT will have to be paid at the point of import. So basically that's a significant impact on businesses in terms of cash flow. Shipments can also be selected then at border for customs examination or be profiled. So you will have goods, trucks, importing, aircraft, declaration of manifest on the goods that are being imported, and you will see an increase in the level of customs examinations that are required. And then one thing that you need to factor in then as well is the additional charges for the clearance of goods. So at the moment, anybody who is importing from a third country will know that there are a requirement to make a customs declaration. Most companies have a logistics provider or a freight forwarder do this on behalf of them, and there's a charge that goes with that. So there's a requirement for you to pay for that service. So it has a significant impact in terms of businesses, in terms of cost around VAT, dutiable products. Previously, no duty would have been paid out, where WTO will require a lot of products where you will have to make a payment of duty. And this will all have to be completed up front. So it's a significant impact in terms of businesses. And also with that then comes compliance and documentation, some of the documentation that's required. Businesses will be required to register for IORI. So that's basically any business that trades within the EU to a third country will be required to register for IORI. You'll be required to have a commercial or pro forma invoice with each shipment that you import or export to the UK in order for the customs declaration to be made. Applying for AEO. AEO is Authorised Economic Operator. It's basically to secure the movement of goods. It's an accreditation for the secure movement and safe movement of goods. So it basically allows companies to get access to simplifications with the customs authorities to move their goods quicker across borders. Proof of payment. So the customs authorities will look to you to provide proof of payment on your goods, VAT registration, products that are imported, for example, some agri goods require import or export licenses. Cert of origins will be required for certain goods in order to apply for relief. And then something that a lot of traders don't have to do at the moment is classifying your product. So basically looking at what your product is and completing classification on the goods. So when we look at some of the considerations, you know, VAT will be applied at 23% at all imports, goods over 22 euro. Duty will be based on the commodity code that's applied to your product. So whatever type of product it is, whatever chapter you fall under, duty will apply on your product. There is a lot of products which are duty free. If there is no trade agreement, it will go to WTO and you will have duty applied on your goods. Setting up a deferment account with revenue. This is another thing to consider where you can have a comprehensive guarantee with revenue where you make the payment of duties and taxes directly to them, which will save you costs in terms of your logistics provider can do this on your behalf, but there is a cost associated with that. Duty and VAT collected prior to release of your goods. This is another thing, you know, in terms of the speed and the movement of your goods, a lot of carriers will require that you make the payment up front if they're moving and they're clearing these goods on your behalf, that the payment of the duty and VAT is made before they release the goods over to you. And then also you will have your as I touched on earlier, your VAT returns. You can still do a reclaim on your VAT, but duty cannot be reclaimed. So that's an extra cost that you have within your business. So it's really on you to understand what your product is, what it's classified as, and is there any duty applicable on your goods, because that is a cost that you will have to your business. And then another thing to consider is Incoterms. What type of Incoterms are you selecting in terms of your terms of trade between the shipper and the receiver of the goods? So again, when we look at customs, I've spoken about IORI. There's just some information here, and this information is available on the revenue website in terms of registering for IORI. So this is something that you all need to consider. And the same for AEO. Now the AEO application is a process that takes some time, and it's going to become a very important part of trading in terms of getting authorized. If you are an authorized economic operator, customs will look at your business as a safe and secure business that is compliant around customs and security. And it is going to become more prevalent in the years to come around moving goods across borders. So then we look at completing an export invoice and some of the things that you need to consider. And I'm not going to go through all of these here, but as you can see, there's a lot of information that's required on a customs invoice. And as you start exporting to the UK, this is the documentation that you will need to provide. All of this information must be declared and attached to your shipment, because on arrival in the UK, this is the document that will be used to clear those goods. If this information is missing, it's just going to hold up your goods through transit. Then we look at the types of Incoterms we have. So Ex Works, so if you look at the terms of trade, Ex Works is basically the buyer bears all the costs and risks involved in taking the goods from the seller's premises to the desired destination. You have FCA, which is the seller's obligation is to hand the goods over. They're cleared for export into the charge of the carrier and the buyer at the name, place, and point. And then you have CIP and DDP, where the difference is there is that the seller pays for the freight, has the responsibility for the insurance, but the responsibility for the clearance is completed by the buyer in terms of the import clearance. And then DDP is that the seller is basically taking all of the responsibility around the delivery, the insurance, the clearance, and the payment of the taxes and the customs formalities. So I spoke a little bit earlier about product classification, and there is ways of looking at your product and just preparing for this, because the tariff code that you select, or the HS code that you select for classifying your goods, is going to dictate the rate of duty that's applied on your product, both at import into Ireland, and if you're exporting to the UK, the rate of duty that may be applicable on import in the UK. So there's information here available in terms of how you classify your product, and there's also on the revenue website gives you a guideline in this. There's a website called Tariq which allows you to classify your product yourself, but you can also then contact revenue directly and they'll be able to give you more information around that. So I suppose the most important thing in terms of importing is around the landed cost. So this includes, you know, the price of the product. It looks at the transportation fees, all of the customs charges that may apply. And I suppose the best slide to show you on this is here, where it shows you all of the duty and VAT calculations. So if you look, this is an import into Ireland. So you have the declared value of the goods, which is €100. In terms of the freight charge, because when customs calculate the duties and taxes, it's based on the intrinsic value. So it includes the cost of the goods, the insurance that you've paid, and the freight that you've paid on the goods. So take, for example, there you have a product that's worth €100. And you add in the freight charge then to move those goods, let's say from point A to point B. That's a charge of €118.50. So your total value for customs purposes is €218.50. So in terms of D there, the first thing that's calculated is the duty. And for this example, I've said that the dutiable rate on this product is 5%, which is €10.93. After the duty is calculated, then it's added to the total value in order to calculate the VAT at 23%. So you see there you have a rate then of 52.76. So your total payable amount of customs for that product is 63.69. So it's a significant amount then that you're going to pay on top of the value of the goods. So you have a purchase of a product, but then you're also looking at that rate of duty and VAT that you need to pay in import. This doesn't take into consideration any charges that you may have in terms of customs service charges by your logistics provider. So to actually then complete this clearance on your behalf, there will be a further charge on top of that. But it just gives you an idea and it kind of summarizes the type of additional charges that you will have in terms of importing from the UK. Now, not every product is dutiable. This is just using in the basis in terms of explaining it. Other things you need to consider is, VAT exemptions, IP authorizations, end-use authorizations, which are going to be touched on in the next presentation. I won't go too much into that. But then you also have things like BTIs, which is basically if you have a product that falls under, you believe, a certain rate of duty, you can apply for a BTI, which allows you then that classifies your product as a specific product under that HS code. So then some of the things around Brexit at the moment, you know, we are staring at the moment into a hard Brexit, and that's what, you know, the EU and all of their communications now is companies need to start preparing for a hard Brexit. And when you look at that, it does have a significant impact around the WTO. So this is where all the trade will be governed by WTO rules. The UK and the EU will impose tariffs on each other, and the UK will in effect be a third country. So this brings us on then into diversification into other markets. So, you know, Ireland has a large exposure to the UK market. but diversification into new markets is a key. You know, Brexit has sparked a move, you know, for a lot of companies to start looking and diversifying it within to the EU. And this is where an opportunity, you know, 65% of purchasing managers are now looking to resource their imports from the EU rather than the UK. And 450 million consumers are currently at your disposal within the EU, and that's excluding the UK. So global markets are more accessible than ever to Ireland. So it's about looking at how you can start looking at those opportunities and diversifying away from UK markets. So an exercise that we did, we tracked 2,000 SMEs post-Brexit, and what we were tracking was what is the impact on the UK volume and what is happening to the shipment profile, you know, in terms of diversification. And what we seen was within those companies, we've seen a 12% growth in their UK volume. But we also seen in their non-UK volume, there was growth of 17%. Especially in US and Canada there, with those particular countries, we've seen a growth of 32%. And then when you're looking at the EU itself, 17% with a growth in these countries here. So it just goes to show there is an opportunity for Irish exporters to start looking at the EU markets and starting to target those consumers in terms of moving your product. So when we look at in terms of e-commerce, by 2020, you know, e-commerce will be worth 4 trillion. That's, you know, approximately 15% of retail sales. You know, you'll have cross-border will outperform domestic transactions. And according to Forrester, Ireland is one of the countries with a strong potential in terms of this. You know, 20% of Irish online retailers, you know, optimize international shipping. And this is something that we're saying to a lot of people, that you need to start looking at, if you are an e-commerce business, you're more likely to sell on your website if you offer international shipping. And it gives you access to international markets where you can sell your product. They're more likely to make an order on your webpage. If you have it on the front of your webpage, we always say it to every e-commerce company, make sure you have international shipping as a service and have it smack bang on your homepage, because you're more likely then to get access to more markets. So you can see there, your website needs to be ready for international shipping. You know, in terms of one thing that we've noticed, you know, from e-commerce, you know, people are buying online, they want it now. It's the Uber age, they, you know, it's the age of immediacy. They want their product now. So it is something where, you know, if you have access, if you are setting up a website, that you look to have international shipping and then offer an express service, because people want our product straight away. So thank you very much. That's my presentation.
Eddie, I'm going to ask you one question.
Yeah.
The slide that you had up there about the 100 euros coming in.
Yes.
That slide actually says that that product is going to be 63% more expensive to bring in on that case after Brexit.
Yeah, based on that's what that slide there we use for, we've used that slide for years in terms of explaining to customers when they're importing from a third country. But that is correct, based on that rate of duty and the rate of VAT. Now, you'll be able to reclaim the VAT, but you can see there that you have a payment up front in terms of that amount and then do your reclaim on your VAT. But the duty will be applicable and there's no reclaim that can be completed on that. That's a payment that you will have to incur within your business.
Okay. And to explain all the, how would you put it, constructive accounting that you can do around VAT and all the rest of it, and getting back your 23%, we have Rory Cole from Cole & Company. Now, Rory is interesting because Rory has got customers both in Ireland and in the UK. So he actually sees what kind of preparations are being made by both of these. So, and, you know, we'll talk about essentially getting to a position where next year, hopefully, we will be no worse off than we are today if he does his job right. Rory.
Thanks very much. Rory Collins, my name is Ted. I run out of actually tax practice in Barnes, so not too far away. So instead of going in the main road, if you want to go in Clifton, the Coast Road, we're just at Donnelly's there, across. But we specialise in tax, so we'll hit on some areas. I was listening to the radio yesterday, and I don't know if you, if anybody knows how many cows we have in Ireland. Anybody have an idea?
3 million.
Yeah, close to 7 to 8 million cows we have in Ireland. And 10% stay here, and 90% go abroad, and 50% of those cows go to the UK. Okay, so that's 2.5 billion a year in beef exports, 50 million a week, 10 million a day. And as my daughter said, where's those cows going to go now? But you can see the extent of the issue is if you're a farmer and, you know, 50% of your cattle exports are going to the UK, and that market then is where those that price is going to go up. So on the financial side, you know, you need to understand, do you even have a business at that stage? This is a quiz I threw up in different places when I've given this presentation. I want to see if the people of Clifton are any smarter. Anybody give me a vote for number one? What eliminates tariffs and non-tariff barriers? Includes the free movement of goods, services, capital, and people. A, B, or C at the bottom. Anybody? Free trade agreement? Single market. B. So includes the free movement of goods, services, capital, and people. Okay. That's what we are in, is a single market. And B, number two is what? C, customs union. Yeah, so we've drawn a big circle around Europe. Anything that comes into Europe, once it comes in, it can move around freely all the time. And that's the problem with, you know, what the UK have, is that something can come into Northern Ireland and then just move freely around. So the big one for number one, A, is that the British don't want the free movement of people. And then C is the free trade area, which is what the British hope to get to. So, you know, even understanding the lingo of what we're dealing with is important. This is how complicated the European Economic Zone is. We have Schengen areas with customs union. Turkey is actually in the customs union, not the EU. You know, so we've all kind of complications in relation to, and the size of the market is huge. I mean, we, if you think of it, Ireland, this is what the British would look at. You know, we're less than 2% of the European population, and we're holding up a signing and an agreement with all of Europe. But that, because as some of the earlier speakers said, you know, 90% of the agreement is more or less done at this stage. It's now just agreeing the last piece of it. So what's going to happen? We have until March 29, 2019. That's not too far away. And people will say it's supposed to go to 2020, December. But that's if we have an agreement. If we don't have an agreement, March 29, 2019 is the date, okay? And they're hoping to extend that. So that's very close. So I'm going to touch, I'm going to jump through some of Eddie's stuff, customs duty and tariffs, then VAT, supply chain, and foreign exchange rates. So here's what I say about the customs. Customs is a real cost. You need to sit down in your business and say, how much is it going to cost me to get this product that I'm bringing in today, and where am I going to get it from? And if it's too expensive from the UK, can I get it from France? Can I get it from Germany? Can I get it from Ireland? Can I get it from somewhere else? And the second thing you're going to find is it's paperwork. I mean, we have a model for Brexit because we deal with third countries. A third country is the US or Russia, any country outside of that we don't deal. So there is a model there today, but the problem is it's paperwork. And you can understand they are looking to hire 800 more customs people. Okay. And they said they're going to have 200 in place, potentially. And that's not even trained up. But you need to understand the paperwork. I mean, if you've ever brought anything in from the US, and I did brought in training books there a couple of weeks back, the wrong code was put on it from the US. The DHL or the UPS guy or whatever wants the money at the door. I can't get my books. I have to ring the US, get the code. So you need to understand, and they get that upskill and training. And Leo will help you, but you need to understand what products are coming in. Are they going to be stuck in Dublin Port? Are they perishable? What's it going to cost me? All the stuff that Eddie talked about in getting paperwork cleared. The analogy I sometimes use is, if you've ever dealt with the planning office, okay, trying to get something approved, the customs office is going to be a lot worse in dealing with it. So you need to manage that process. And upskilling and training, who's going to do it? It's a whole new process for a lot of people. We haven't had customs. Are you going to get DHL to do it? Are you big enough? Are you going to do it yourself? But that's a whole skill set is even managing that. This is a sample of some of the tariffs that are going to apply. And I mean, if you look at the ones that are 5%, I mean, if you're a 10% margin business, like just understand your margins, you're 10% margin business, and you're 5% coming on the top line there, that's 50% of your profits potentially gone tomorrow. Okay. So this is a real cost. Can you pass it on? Even we'll talk about review of contracts, which Eddie spoke about. Who's going to pay this? I mean, are you guaranteeing to You might just have a term in your contract that says, I guarantee to deliver duty paid product cleared to my UK customers. Or you might have something from your supplier coming in that says, you have to clear it, and you have to pay it. Okay? So you need to go through your contracts and understand, or if you're writing new contracts, look down at them and see who's going to pay these costs. But that gives you a good idea. And the animal products and agriculture sector is really going to struggle. If you have 50% of our cattle or beef exports going to the UK and you see, you know, something around 20 or 30% on it. Customs issue, Eddie talked about this. I mean, this is as simple as you need to know what the code is of your product coming in. If they're exported, you need to get EORI number. This is just to revenue IE. You do need to have an EORI number. Give you a statistic. There's 25,000 people who have EORI numbers today of businesses in Ireland, okay? There's 250,000 people who have a VAT number, okay? And if you look at the VAT returns, which is what revenue have, they will say there's probably, on the Interstat, they'll say 92,000 people currently deal over and back with the UK. So now we're moving from 25,000 people, I think you had a factor of 4 or 5, to 100,000 people who deal with the UK who are going to have to get this EORI number. So, I mean, tomorrow or the next day, if you're dealing with the UK, you at least need that number. You may not need some of the other stuff like the trusted trader status, because that's complicated to get, but you need to know that you have that number and can you defer payment. So one of the things you look at is your goods arrive in Dublin, you need to get them into your supply chain, you need to get them cleared, and customs are looking for payment. Okay. Now you can set up a deferred payment situation where you get a number and you give that to DHL, you're clear, they put it on the system and they clear the goods for you. However, they want a bank guarantee. So you need to be talking to your bank and saying, okay, I need a guarantee to put in place because I do not want to pay cash every time my goods arrive in and I get a call in. You know, it's just delays, delays, delays. So bank guarantee is really important that you need to get this in place if you're clearing goods. And then you need to talk about who's clearing goods into the UK. I think Eddie's example was similar here. This was just one off the revenue website. Digital camera, €600, turns into €819. Adult footwear, €900, turns into €1,456. So my point is, if you're bringing products in, you need to know what the landed cost is here. What's it going to cost you? Because it may make no sense. I mean, your business may not be viable once you run the numbers in relation to saying, under my current supply chain status, I can't afford to bring in stuff from the UK if my duty rate is going to be this or whatever. I need to find an alternative supplier for my product. But you need to run those numbers on your products, get the right commodity code. So there's a whole paperwork exercise around that. Again, I won't get too much detail. If you're bringing products in for processing and then you're re-exporting them again, there are situations like bonded warehouses, inward-outward processing, you know, you can get a deferment of the duty and stuff. So you just, again, you need to work with the customs expert or whatever, and then Obreda Fox from Leo will talk about grants being available just to understand your supply chain and the costs around that. If you're number five there, if your products are going to Europe and they have to cross the UK, so again, you're talking about 4 hours to Holyhead versus 36 hours to Belgium, to go around. And I was listening to a guy there recently. He said, if I have a delay, you know, the truck drivers are allowed to drive for 15 hours, you know, so you could find maximum 3 times a week. So you could have that issue even pop up. Perishable products, you know, going to Landbridge. So crossing the UK, there's another document there called a TAT. I mean, again, you don't need to remember all of this stuff. You just need to understand, how does this affect me as I go through it? Okay, VAT. So as a rule, VAT follows the customs duty. So what happens is product comes in, you're clearing it, and the VAT has to be paid at point of entry. Today, you just enter it. And example three is a good one. So let's say, for example, you're a VAT registered trader. You're bringing in goods into Ireland, and you have to set up a direct debit arrangement with revenue. Okay. So on January, that comes out of your account on February 15th, if you have a deferred payment arrangement, okay, which is the bank guarantee. Your February imports come out of your bank account on March 15th, okay? And then you file your VAT return on March 19th, okay? So let's say you're bringing in goods of 100,000 a month, your VAT rate is 23%, and your GD rates are 7%, 30. So you might have a 30,000 bill or a guarantee to put in place with the bank for that every 2 month period, okay? Does that make sense? So today you just give your VAT number and the stuff arrives at your door, correct? There's no duty, there's no VAT. So if you're a small person, or small business or large business, I mean, even if you're bringing in 10,000 every 2 months, you might have to find 3,000 of extra cash to fund on it, okay? And then again, understanding the paperwork process around it. Okay, foreign exchange. I mean, this shows the movement. I mean, if you're dealing in sterling customers, I mean, you can shows the movement. I mean, it's highly volatile, but actually the most volatile currency pair in the world that's traded is actually dollar euro. It's not euro sterling. You can see from 140 to whatever. My point in currency and foreign exchange is you need to manage it. You know, if you're invoicing in sterling and you cannot take that hit, you need to look, should I transfer that risk to my customer? I've got a number of clients who are just going back to the customer saying, I am invoicing you in euro from now on, or I can only buy in euro. I'm not saying that's always possible, but you can't take movement swings of 15% on your product that you can't pass on in relation to it. So a couple of things in foreign exchange. What I say to people is, what is my sterling break-even rate? What does it mean? At what foreign exchange rate do I start to lose money? You need to understand that. Okay? If the currency goes to 1-1, am I losing money? Okay? And you need to know that now in relation to it. Prepare a sterling and euro cash flow. You know, just rather than ruin it all together, look at what are my inflows and outflows in sterling, and then understand my exposure. Open a sterling bank account. I actually have a UK business that I do some work with. I opened a sterling bank account with Global Markets, Bank of Ireland, I'm happy to say, Paddy. And I tried to then get a credit card linked to it, and the UK company wouldn't recognize the Irish IBAN number. So I've been talking to a couple of clients about this, and the way around it is actually to open a sterling account in Newry, which Bank of Ireland can facilitate through their local branches. So then you're at least in the UK payments area and payment system, and it's much quicker. So again, another thing that you should be doing the next week or two is, if you have transactions in sterling, customers are paying you in sterling, if that shuts down or whatever, get your sterling bank account opened in Newry with Bank of Ireland. If you don't bank with Bank of Ireland, you can talk to Paddy afterwards. Consider hedging. I mean, hedging is where you go to the bank and say, I've got a contract, I'm going to get 100,000 sterling in 6 months' time. I like today's exchange rate, plus or minus. I guarantee for that 100,000 sterling, I'm going to get 112,000 euro. I can make money at that. You can do that, okay? But generally, you can't do it on an ongoing business. You can do it where, you know, McHale's are selling a machine and they're guaranteed a price and they know the price they can get, they make money at. But really, you need to look and say, does it make sense for me to be taking that risk? And it may not. You may need to just say, I can deal in euro on this, I can't deal in sterling on it, or switch. Issue contracts in euro, as I said. Natural hedge. Natural hedge means that, hey, I have a lot of sterling coming in here. I'm currently buying my supplies in from a European guy. You know, the UK is getting a bit cheaper, you might switch it to a UK supplier. So the natural hedge means if I have 1,000 sterling coming in, I hold it in my sterling bank account, and I pay 1,000 sterling out to my suppliers. And the UK is pretty cheap to buy stuff now as well with the exchange rates. If you ever shop in Joyce's in Galway, you'll see sterling prices on the stuff. And then revisit contracts with a currency share agreement. So that means you're talking to your customers, talking to your suppliers. They're not going to allow you to deal in euro with them. You say, okay, I cannot make money if it goes to 1-1. You need that conversation today. You know, so you say, okay, we'll agree today's rate plus or minus 5%. And if it hits plus or minus 5, then we'll re-talk again and reset it. Okay, so there's a sharing arrangement on it. Okay, supply chain. 475,000 containers left Ireland, okay, to the UK in 2017, 1,300 per day. Okay. Guinness did a study. Guinness has 18,000 trucks crossing the border every year. Okay? because they fill the cans for Guinness in the north and then they send them back to the south again. They said if there's a 10-minute delay, it'll cost them 1.3 million euro. Okay? That's just Guinness. Okay? 1.3 crossing the border. And we don't have a lot of options to get to. I mean, if you look at your supermarket shelf today, 70% of everything on your supermarket shelf is coming from the UK or has come through the UK to get to Ireland. Okay? So you're gonna. So again, you need to look at, you know, if you're in business, you need to look and say, it's like the, if there was a petrol strike, you need to store stuff and say, I need to be able to keep my business in operation, and you may need to bring the stuff across and get it here today and store it, do a deal with your supplier, say, okay, I need extended credit terms, I need 90 days until we see what happens in relation to it. As I said, lead times, perishable products. You know, what does a day do? What does 2 days do? What does 3 days do to your product in relation to it? Okay, so just very quickly to wrap up, supply chain. So what is my supply chain today? How do I get products in? How do I get products out? And what are the paperwork and skills training I need or I need to outsource to do that work in relation to it? Okay. What is my customs duties and costs? What's it going to cost me to get my products in or products out? Can I make money on it? The deferred payment scheme. You need to get the deferred payment scheme in operation, would be my advice to you. You need to get your bank guarantee. You cannot have a situation where you've been called up, your goods are held. Even if DHL do that for you, they're not going to give you the goods until you pay them when they arrive. Correct, Eddie? You're not going to release the goods because you're not a bank, correct? Yeah. So you need to put that financing in place so that the goods, there's not a holdup saying, please send us money to clear your goods. And then even what bank account you lodge to. So you need that deferred payment arrangement in place if you're importing goods. Contracts review, okay? And again, that's important. Who's paying for this stuff? You know, everything is a cost. I mean, I would even say, if you're doing new contracts today, or you say, you put it in, something says, we don't know what's going to happen on Brexit, but we know that we can't cover these costs, and or at least we're going to sit down and discuss them. Look at your foreign exchange exposure. What is your break-even rate? At what rate can you not make money at? And open your sterling bank account. And then long-term, what's your business structure? Does it even make sense to be selling or importing stuff from the UK? I have a number of clients. They're actually just buying UK businesses. They might even set up a branch in the UK. They might set up a subsidiary company in the UK just to facilitate all that stuff. So long-term, does it make sense for you to even... I mean, you can't be in business and lose money, but at least you need to know that. I mean, and then the other last thing I'd finish at is, if you look at about a statistic, 97, 98% of the businesses in the world that shut down due to lack of money. Okay? So you're going to need a cash cushion. Breed will talk about it on the panel. There is grants available. There's loan schemes available, unguaranteed up to $500,000, 4% interest rates. So again, I always say, the best time to be asking a bank for money is when you don't really need it, okay? So again, you need to be putting some cash cushion in place and the stuff there. Okay, thanks very much.